Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. This week, we will be taking you to the recent 32nd Annual Camden Conference at the Camden Opera House for a series of talks surrounding this year's theme, Is This China's Century? Today's talk is by keynote speaker Martin Jakes and is titled, What China Will Be Like as a Great Power. Martin Jakes is a senior fellow at Cambridge University and a visiting professor at Tsinghua and Fudan Universities. He is the author of the global bestseller When China Rules the World, The End of the Western World and the Birth of a New Global Order, and has been an editor, columnist, or essayist for more than 30 leading publications in the United States, Europe, and Asia. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainpublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Here is today's speaker, Martin Jakes.
China, what's it going to be like as a global power? Well, 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have asked this question with a sense of imminence. We could see China rising dramatically, but we didn't see it at that stage as a great power. 10 years later, the situation is very different. First, there's the decline of the United States, following or accentuated by the Western financial crisis. And secondly, there's the rise of China, again, following the Western financial crisis and the doubling in size of China, the Chinese economy in the subsequent 10 years compared with the American economy growing by about 10% in that period. And as a result of these changes under Xi Jinping, there's been a shift in Chinese foreign policy, which I think we're all aware of, which is moving from the Deng Xiaoping's idea of moving carefully, quietly, hiding your capability, hiding your leadership, to something which is much more outgoing and expansive, moving to the idea that China was not just a recipient of globalization, a player in globalization, but was also a maker and shaper of globalization. We're in a new situation. One of the difficulties, I think, that we've had in the West is we've always been on the back foot. We've always been a bit on the defensive. We've always been a bit behind the game when it came to China. We didn't really believe in it beyond the point. We didn't believe it was sustainable. And now I think we have to face the fact that this is a remarkable change that's taking place, and we somehow have to be able to make sense of it, to understand it. But the Achilles heel in the West has been that really we don't understand China. In some profound way, we don't understand China. And the reason for this is that our paradigm is that we are universal, that everyone should be, one day will be, is required to be like us. That there's only one modernity in the world. It's our modernity. Now, frankly, this is no longer a sustainable position. It hasn't been a sustainable position for a while, but it's absolutely not sustainable any longer in the world, because we see not only the transformation of China, but so many developing countries which do not come from the same historical, political, cultural roots as the West. And we have to now try and understand, in this context, the difference that is China. China has never been like the West, It isn't like the West, and it never will be like the West. I don't mean that there aren't connections, similarities, and so on, but there are some fundamental differences which are enduring differences. Now, I want to make 3 points in this context. The first is that China, we think of countries being essentially nation states. But China is not in any simple way a nation state. China, this was at the beginning of China, these are rather crude maps I've got here, but 2,000 years ago, over 2,000 years ago, the beginning of China as a polity. The Han Dynasty, still over 2,000 years ago, you can already see is occupying a large part of the eastern part of China. It was only at the end of the 19th century when China got into big, big trouble and what became very divided and occupied in parts that China finally conceded that it should be a nation state. In other words, it adapted to the European, then European norms of the international system. And it began to call itself a nation state. So, you know, that's what, 120, 130 years ago, something like that? That's a sliver of time when you consider a 2,000 odd year history of China. So to understand China, we've got to understand it, in my view, primarily not as a nation state, primarily as a civilization state. That its inheritance is a civilizational inheritance. That ideas about the relationship between the state and society, Confucian values, the role of the individual within Chinese society, traditions like Guanxi, a certain type of relationships, networks in China, or even Chinese food for that matter, Chinese language, are civilizational inheritances of China which way predate the period of it being a nation state. So China is a civilization state and a nation state, and this marks it out, I think, in all sorts of ways. If we tease the different aspects of China properly, tease out the differences that that China is about. And there's another example of this, and you know, China, of course, is huge. Those four provinces of China are bigger, have a bigger population between them than that of the United States. But the point I want to make here is that China, we think of China as often, you know, a very centralized country run from Beijing and so on, which isn't true, actually. It would be impossible to run a country the size of China, 1.4 billion people nearly, from Beijing. China has many many different customs, many different cultures, although its primary language is Mandarin, many different languages spoken, and so on. And so China learnt over a long historical period, pre-communist period, I mean, I'm talking about the imperial period, that the only way that China could really operate and could hang together was if it was on the basis of a certain sort of respect for difference, if you like, or to put it another way, one civilization, many systems. And so, for example, this lives on today. If you look at the handover of Hong Kong in 1997, Deng Xiaoping's idea was one country, two systems. Very different way of thinking to that of a nation state, drawn from the tradition of Chinese civilization. A nation state would never think like that. I mean, German unification, it was one nation, one system. That's our tradition in the West. That's where it comes from, our history. Likewise, the tradition of one country, two systems comes from a different civilizational tradition. So this is very fundamental. Or take another crucial difference about China, which is the relationship between state and society. Now we, and I understand this, and you know, I've been through this myself, we think of governance in countries as essentially about universal suffrage, multi-party system, And China doesn't have that. And for that reason, we've long believed in the West that the Chinese system, as we know it today, is unsustainable, is illegitimate. But it's, I don't think if you look at the work that's been done on Chinese governance, if you look at the Pew Global Attitude surveys and so on, about the levels of satisfaction amongst the Chinese with Chinese governance, that's a really sustainable position. It's clear that the Chinese governing system, different though it, hugely different though it is from our own in the West, enjoys a great deal of support and legitimacy. But what is the nature of this legitimacy? It can't be the same as ours because we see it in terms of that democratic tradition that I've just described. Now, in China, the difference is, I think, crucially based on three factors. First of all, the state is seen as the guardian and the embodiment of society. This is inconceivable that this would be the case in the United States, but in China it is the case, and it goes back a long time. We're not just talking now about periods since 1949, we're going back, you know, 2,000 years for this tradition. Secondly, the idea of governance in China is drawn powerfully from the notion of the family. I mean, Confucius's idea of the role of the emperor was that the emperor should model himself on a good father. It was a patriarchal tradition, of course, then. And so it was a family unit that, that acted as the microcosm, if you like, of China as a country. Or thirdly, the tradition of meritocracy, the importance of meritocracy, which goes at least back to the Tang Dynasty, 1500, 1600 years ago. So these are things which together the Chinese see governance in a different way to the way we see it. And it can be, as we've seen, extremely effective. And the third and the final difference, which brings me to the subject of my talk tonight, is China's place in the world, China's role in the world. Now, you know, it's strange to say, but Europe and the United, Europe and China shared a very important thing in their prime period. They both, in a sense, regarded themselves to be universal. That they were superior forms of being, if you like, to those that existed elsewhere. But the way in which they interpreted this proposition was very different. Europe interpreted this proposition essentially as an evangelizing mission to transform the world, to take the message of civilization to those who were not civilized through the colonial mission, through Christianity, through language, through the culture, and so on. And I suppose the prime, most extreme expression of this was the height of European colonialism prior to 1914. Now, China's interpretation of universalism was entirely different. China did not see it in terms of externalizing itself, because the Chinese idea of their universalism was we are the Middle Kingdom. We are the land under heaven. We are the highest form of civilization. So why leave China? What's the point of leaving China when, as it were, we are all that could be? So the Chinese interpretation of universalism was essentially a stay-at-home universalism, whereas the European version was to go overseas, to go around the world. That's why the United States is the United States, because it was a product of that evangelizing mission of European civilization and European colonialism. Now, these differences are very important to understanding today the difference between, I think, the Chinese way of seeing the world and China's role in the world, and that of the West, the United States in particular, of course, as by far the most important Western country. Now, the characteristic forms of all countries that expand is, firstly, economic, that you cannot become a great power unless you have a powerful economy. And that, therefore, the major players globally, historically, in the modern period, Britain, then the United States and China, have all shared this characteristic in varying degrees. So that is an important commonality. But beyond that, I think I would say, looking back at the history of the West on the one hand and China on the other, here we have a marked difference, a marked disparity, because military power and political power and political control have been extremely important in the Western tradition. I mean, maybe the highest form of this, as I said before, was colonialism, but it's been extremely important in the way in which the Western tradition has related to the rest of the world. Now, China is rather different. Do you know, in the 500 years from the mid 14th century to the mid 19th century, China only fought one major war with another country, which was Vietnam, which they got a bloody nose and eventually were defeated and had to retreat. There were only two major wars, actually, in that whole 500-year period between major nations, countries in Asia, compared with, say, 142 wars just between Britain and France. I say it's true, in that same 500-year period. So, for the Chinese, actually, you know, the Chinese had this system called, it's become called, the, at least in Western terms, the tribute system. And the tribute system lasted for probably about 3,000 years, the longest existing international system, or partial international system in the world. And this was essentially, it was not a military system. The Chinese did not, apart from that Vietnamese example, invade other countries. It did not, by and large, interfere in the politics of other countries. So there isn't a strong tradition, or any real tradition beyond a point in China, of exercising military or political power. What mattered to the Chinese was cultural power. That if you were going to be a tribute state of China, then you had to recognize the role of the empire, the superiority of the empire, the land and the heaven, the Middle Kingdom, and Confucian values. You were required to do that. As long as you did that, you could more or less do anything, up to a point. But that was essentially the Chinese system. So we have here a very interesting point of departure in comparing the Western tradition historically and the Chinese tradition. Strong emphasis on military and political power in the Western tradition, strong emphasis on cultural power in the Chinese tradition. The economic power is shared, but it's also, I think, got to be said that in the future, Chinese economic power, because of demography, is likely to be much greater than anything we've historically seen, much greater, relatively speaking, than compared with the United States, even in its prime, at the end of the 40s and 1950s. Okay, so this brings me, slipping through history, to the present. What are going to be, I can't cover all this ground, obviously, because there's a lot of things to say, but let's say, if I've got time, the seven key characteristics or elements of China as a global power. Of course, they are Well, partly they're rooted in a reality we can already see. Partly I'm speculating, and who knows whether I'll be right or not. My first point is indeed about China's economic power. And I think that, we have to recognize, and I think we do recognize, that China's economic transformation has been remarkable. Even now, as of 2015, it's already represented 15% of global GDP. And I think the figure now is something like 16 or 17% of global GDP, which is remarkable given in 1980 China represented about 1% of global GDP. And the prospects, well, who knows whether this will become true, but these are some figures from Huanggong at Tsinghua University. And this is based on GDP measured in terms of primary purchasing power, not exchange rates. It would be different if it was exchange rates. But in 2030 or 2035, these projections are always speculative, China would account for a third of global GDP, which, by the way, is what China accounted for in 1820. So there is a tradition, if you go back far enough, of this, followed by India then. And of course, second here is India, at 90%. But the Chinese economy, bigger than the American and the EU economies together, and twice the size of the American economy. Now, many a slip, tricks, cup and lip. These kind of projections, I think, broadly speaking, will come true. But maybe significantly slow. I mean, there's lots of things that can happen in the meantime that could change that situation. But I think that we would be, given recent history, we would be mistaken in not taking these kind of possibilities very, very seriously. And I think it immediately emerges here that actually China's economic power is going to be, as I mentioned, disproportionate compared with anything we've ever witnessed in modern times previously, disproportionate even compared with that of the United States, and certainly with Britain. I mean, did you know that Britain never accounted, even at its highest point, it accounted for about 8.5% of global GDP, and never larger than that, but was able to have an empire which was controlled a fifth of the world and a fifth of the world's population. But it never had that strong an economy.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk features Camden Conference keynote speaker Martin Jakes on what China will be like as a great power.
So my second point about China as a global power, is about its relationship with the developing world. Now, there is no doubt at all that the most important bilateral relationship to China is that with the United States. And it also regards its relationship, well, in a rather different way, with the European Union to be very important. But strategically speaking, I don't think that is an accurate way of seeing how China views its relationship and its priorities in terms of the world. I think that China's most important strategic priority in its thinking is its relationship with the developing world. Now, I think that a key part of the explanation for this is where China's come from. China, of course, in 1978, when Deng Xiaoping's reforms started, was extremely poor and was poorer than a lot of African countries in terms of per capita income. And so therefore it's seen itself as having a certain affinity and with the developing world, that it understands the problems of the developing world. Furthermore, of course, there were other attractions of its relationship with the developing world. For example, China, like other East Asian countries, Japan, Korea, is very poor in natural resources. And China, to fuel its industrial transformation, needed large amounts of raw materials. So the relationship with Africa, which actually dates back a long time to the 1950s, was very important to China. But I think above all, it feels also that it understands developing countries. It understands what the problems are developing countries. And I think this is a fair proposition. And China is obviously much closer to that situation, that experience, and that need than the United States or European countries, which are much richer. And so the mind of the population in our countries, in the rich world, is very different, is in a different place to that of those in the developing world and in China. So China, I think, sees its future very much in terms of its relationship with the developing world. This explains why, for example, it's developed such a strong relationship with African countries. Now, there have been a lot of criticisms of China's relationship with the African countries. But I think that if you look at public opinion, for example, in Africa, according to Pew and so on, China, the majority attitude, 60-65% of Africans have what is called a favorable attitude towards China. And one of the things China's done is by becoming a serious source of demand for African raw materials from those countries that produce a lot, has boosted the prices. And one of the reasons why I think African growth rates over the last 10 years, probably the biggest single reason why African growth rates are now very strong in some countries, is because of this relationship with China. Also, I mean, China, unlike the West, the Europe, America wasn't really involved in this, but European countries, has been generous in terms of and recognized the importance of providing infrastructure and so on. It's made mistakes, it's criticized, and so on. But I think that you can see from this, you know, the role that China has been playing. Unfortunately, the American relationship with Africa, the trade has been falling, but you can see that China's been a very important player. And I think this is likely to continue. And just bear in mind here, a very important point. Do you know that in the mid-1970s, 2/3 of global GDP was accounted for by the Western world, which is roughly 15%, it's been declining, but let's say 15-16% of the global population, and only 1/3 by the developing world, where 85% of the world's population lives. Today, the figures are, this year, are 59% is now accounted for by the developing world, and I'll get my figures right here, 39% by the developed world. And the projection for 2030 is that the developing world, called South here, will account for 67% of global GDP and only 33% by the rich world. So China's relationship as a very populous developing country itself, but now an upper middle income country, you can see that thinking of the future, how important this is going to be to China as a great power. Third point, Belt and Road. Now, of course, this is not, in a way, I think China sort of learnt a lot about dealing with the developing world, cut its teeth with Africa in the period of the last 20 years or so. And Belt and Road is, as you, I'm sure, are all aware, is a hugely ambitious project to transform the Eurasian landmass, where there are many, many very poor countries, although there are also rich countries. At the end of the Eurasian landmass is somewhere called Europe, which is certainly not poor. But the idea, I think, is this. The Chinese thinking in relationship to Belt and Road is, look, how did we transform our country? We transformed our country by economic growth based on very large scale, large scale investment, usually state investment, and especially directed at infrastructure. I mean, you know, China does have, for a developing country, an extraordinary infrastructure of expressways, of railways, and a larger high-speed rail network than the rest of the world put together. China have really majored on infrastructure in a big way. And I think this has been so important to the development of China because it's created a connectivity across China, which has drawn the country together and allowed the market to develop in the kind of way that it has. And I think the Chinese thinking in relationship to Belt and Road is, if it worked for us, why can't it work for the many countries of Central Asia, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and so on. Well, that I think is essentially the Chinese thinking in relation to Belt and Road. And you know, bear in mind that about 65% of the world's population lives in this landmass. Now, how's it gone? Well, you know, they came out of the traps running hard, and a great deal of money has already been invested. There's been a lot of enthusiasm hitherto from not all the countries in the Eurasian landmass, but I think there's 71 countries are lying along the route. Belt and Road, I know it's crazy language, but believe it or not, I always get confused about this. The belt is the land route and the road is the maritime route. Can you imagine that? So I don't know why they just didn't stick to the name Silk Roads, because we all kind of know what that means, but there you go. So a lot of enthusiasm from many countries for the project, because they can see the possibilities of how their circumstances could be transformed. The two key countries that have not signed up for it and are Japan and India, and they were not represented at the big summit 2 years ago in Beijing. But many, many countries were at very high levels, usually often at the highest level of all. Western Europe was represented, most governments, but not at the highest level, usually. I think that gives you a sort of rough picture of what the support, what the attitude was. Now, the United States attitude, as it was on the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, was to not get involved, not join in, and so on, and has recently been to develop an alternative approach. Personally, I think this is a mistake. I think the United States should get involved, because if it's not involved, then it's not a player in terms of the rules, the regulations, the projects, and so on. And personally, I think the alternative program will just be too weak in terms of its funding. I mean, China's throwing a lot of money at it, and I don't think America's in a position to do that at the moment, or in the for the foreseeable future. Now, it is also true, and must be emphasized, that China's run into some serious problems in different countries with Belt and Road, notably Myanmar, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Malaysia, some criticisms in Pakistan. So what is the problem here? Well, the biggest criticism of China in this context is, the most recent criticism anyway, is that in extending loans to these countries, usually very good interest rates, around about 2%, these countries have taken on debt burdens, which will see them in big trouble. And I think that China has China has a problem in this context. Why? Well, you know, this is a vast program. So some Chinese companies, some state-owned companies and so on, they rush into it, they want to do a deal. The Chinese banks are backing it, China Development Bank and so on, and they take on commitments which are excessive under the circumstances, where they need to go slowly rather than very quickly. I think a lack of political awareness, political nous. I mean, Malaysia, classic example. Malaysia historically has been quite close to China. Mahathir, I know, who I happen to know, is very pro-China, but he's been very critical of China in this context. Why? Because the previous government of Najib undertook these big commitments, got lots of loans from China, and put the country in a lot of debt. And now Najib was a particularly corrupt figure, and now Mahathir's cancelled, or not yet cancelled, but suspended some of the key projects like the East Rail route. So I think that there's a certain degree of sometimes greed, sometimes corruption, sometimes just rushing into things, lack of knowledge about the political circumstances of different countries, lack of awareness of the importance of civil society and civil society organisations and so on. So I think that is very important. What's going to happen? Well, I think what's going to happen is the Chinese will renegotiate all these agreements where they under a lot of pressure. I don't think it'll bring Belt and Road down. I don't think the Chinese will let that happen. I don't think they can let it happen. But it is a warning to them. But in the longer run, what do I think? I think that Belt and Road basically is going to be successful. On what scale? I don't know. Remember, we're talking about a very long-term project. I mean, I don't think we're talking about 10 years or 20 years. We're talking about 50 years or more than that. This is a most extraordinary objective. But what I think is going to happen is, and you can see this map here is by Danny Kwa, who was at LSE, London School of Economics, and he tries to understand, try to work out very complex econometrics where the centre of the global economy is. And he estimated that in 1980, it was those yellow spots just off the African coast, and he's seen it moving, and now he thinks it's just above the Arabian Peninsula that is now the centre of the global economy. And he predicts it'll be, by 2050, on the Sino-Indian border. So, and the transformation of the Eurasian landmass as a result of Belt and Road can only accelerate and underline that kind of development. That's one point I would make. The second point I would make is that don't underestimate the kind of transformation in governance that is likely to come from Belt and Road. Many countries, at the moment, there aren't really strong regional organisations across large parts of the landmass. And I think what we're going to see is a transformation in the idea of the nation state, new regional entities being created. In other words, a revolution in governance across the region in ways that at the moment I can't predict exactly what they'll be. But I think there would be inevitable consequence of this process. And the other thing I think is almost inevitable, especially if Europe and United States are not particularly involved in it, and that is the increasing importance of the Chinese renminbi as a currency in these areas, increasing importance of Chinese ideas about how these kind of projects should be organized, their legal basis, and so on. Two courts are being established, one in Xi'an and one in Shenzhen, to hear commercial disputes in Belt and Road projects, which is an illustration of this point. So that is Belt and Road, and a very important project. Now, this brings me to just a couple of points that I want to make, which is very quickly. In terms of US-China relations, we shouldn't exaggerate the importance of Chinese military expenditure. China is not Russia. The Soviet Union was believed in military competition and the arms race, and you can see even today when the country is much weaker and much poorer, it still places a disproportionate emphasis on military expenditure. I don't think China is like that. Takes me back to the earlier point about history and China not essentially regarding military power with the same priority as is true in the West and certainly in the case of Russia. And the other point I want to make before just finally making some points about US-China relations, and that is China is also not going to be a political meddler. Why? Because China thinks it's different, it's unique, it's not a model for others, and it has an agnostic attitude, actually, a relatively agnostic attitude towards political systems wherever they are. This brings me to my final points about the United States and China. We are now, as we all can see very clearly, in new waters, in new territory, as far as the relationship between the United States and China is concerned. The era that started with Nixon Mao in 1972 has come to an end. Why has it come to an end? Because the United States has shifted its position. Not just Trump, I think, but more widely across American society. Why has it shifted its position? Because I think for a long time, America saw China not as a rival beyond a point to the United States. It was a very, very unequal relationship. But we can all see that that balance has changed. And now there's a feeling in America that China in some ways is a threat, or certainly a challenge to the United States. I would say, first, that it is impossible for the United States to stop the rise of China, unless we're talking about nuclear war, but then we're all dead anyway. The rise of China is one of these great, quite unusual historical moments of a fundamental transformation taking place in the world. I mean, the rise of Europe and the decline of China in the 17th and 18th century was also one of these great historical trends, historical periods. The United States cannot stop the rise of China. This is impossible. It has to try and find a way of relating to China in this new context. Second point I want to make. The problem of the relationship between, the competitive relationship between China and the United States is not fundamentally about trade. It's fundamentally about innovation. Now, there has been a very strong view in the West that China was not capable of serious innovation. That China was good at copying, good at imitating, but when it came to creative change, radical change, China would not be able to succeed. Now, I think this was a profound misconception. You see, ever since 1978, it's true that in the early decades, China was by and large taking existing technologies and applying them to the new circumstances in China. But even that kind of approach is not simply copying. It involves a process of incremental innovation, not radical innovation, but it's nonetheless innovation. And I think across Chinese society, when it was growing at 10% a year or now 7% a year, this led to an enormous buildup of innovative capacity, of innovative thinking across Chinese society. This was not just, you know, this has been going on for a long time. And now China's reached the point where it is capable of competing in areas which you and I, certainly I didn't, expect China to emerge as a serious player in the world. I mean, you know, the United States has had a monopoly, basically, of a lot of technologies, particularly those coming from Silicon Valley. And yet, within a very short space of time, maybe 10 years, less than 10 years, firms like Tencent and Alibaba have emerged as, you know, on a par with the top American technology firms. And Huawei has to be included in this category. So China's rise, economic rise, is going to be a formidable challenge to the United States. And the only way that I think America, I think it's a mistake for America to react in a protectionist way to this. I mean, I'm not saying don't do any protection whatsoever under any circumstances, but in general, the danger of protectionism is that you withdraw, it's a defensive response, when in fact, basically, for example, it's very, very important that American firms are competing in China because China is becoming such a competitive, ruthlessly competitive and dynamic economy. So you have to be part of it to learn from it, because learning is going to be very important in relationship to how we in the West respond to the rise of China. My last point, and I'll finish with this, is the key question, I think, for us in the West is, and particularly for the United States, is to find a way of relating to China based on a different assumption. The assumption can no longer be we are number one in the world and we will just defend what we have achieved, because the situation has changed. China is a serious competitor in many fields now to the United States. So we have to do what my country has not been good at, my country being Britain, which is learning to live in a world which is not the same as we've lived in for a long time. And we've found it very difficult in my country. Brexit debate is a fantastically good illustration of this. We found it very difficult to move on. And I think the great challenge for the United States will be how to live in a world where China is a peer competitor. What are the forms of cooperation and what are the forms of rivalry? This is the question raised in Thucydides' Trap by Graham Allison. You know, how does the United States deal with this challenge other than putting up the barriers and threat and becoming more military, for example, as a response? This isn't going to work. This cannot be the future. So this is the great challenge that faces the West, particularly the United States, in response to the rise of China as a great power. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was Camden Conference keynote speaker Martin Jakes, discussing what China will be like as a great power. He spoke at the recent 32nd annual Camden Conference. Upcoming Speaking in Maine programs will feature additional talks from the conference. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.